I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Most of the antibiotics in this country are used on chickens, cows, and pigs, added to their feed, mixed in their water, and sometimes given as an injection. For years, public health advocates have been concerned that these drugs could pose a risk to the humans who eat meat and poultry. Earlier this spring, the Food and Drug Administration issued guidelines to reduce the use of antibiotics in agriculture, but many said it did not go far enough. They wanted an outright ban. This issue, along with concerns about the use of other drugs and additives and the controversy over pink slime, got us thinking about what and how we eat. We have two guests who have joined us today on Radio Times. Keith Nachman is Director for Farming for the Future at Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. He's a food production expert, recently co-authored a study on chicken feed additives. And Keith Nachman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Michael Pollan, author of a number of books, including Food Rules and Eater's Manual, which has been released in an illustrated edition, In Defense of Food and the Omnivore's Dilemma. He's also the Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. And Michael Pollan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Good to be back.
Nice to have you back. And Michael, if I could begin with you, should we be worried about what we eat?
Well, we should be concerned. We should pay attention. We should be conscious. I don't think we have to go around worried all the time. There are things we're eating that are worrisome, that's for sure. But, like this issue of antibiotics in meat and livestock, it's not a direct threat when you eat a hamburger from a cow that's been treated with it, but it's a public health threat, a larger public health threat. So that's why we need to be concerned.
But are we also talking about some of the consequences of the industrial farming, industrial agriculture that we use in this country?
Yeah, well, we have a very sick food system in many ways, and which is one reason that we're struggling with such a high rates of chronic disease. There are food safety challenges. There are issues of pesticide residue. There's a whole, panoply of issues. But I think the thing to do is to get organized and bring pressure to bear on the industry, which is what's happening. I mean, we're seeing some very positive changes, and we're seeing a lot of resistance. But rather than worry, I'd put our efforts into taking action.
Keith Nachman, let me get you in on the conversation. I'm interested in some of the research that you've been doing, including some research on chicken feed additives. And one of the things that you looked at was feather meal. Help us understand what you were looking for and what you found.
Sure. So we raise about 9 billion broiler chickens or meat chickens each year. And as part of that production process, one byproduct of slaughtering those animals is a product called feather meal, which is essentially chicken feathers that have been heated up to kill bacteria and then ground into a fine powder. And that powder is used as a component in animal feed for chickens, for swine, for cattle, and for fish, and is also used as an organic fertilizer. And we initially started looking into feather meal because it's of its use in fish feed, but I have a background in studying the use of arsenic in food animal production, and knowing how similar chicken feathers are in terms of the tissue type to human fingernails, and since we use human fingernails to look for exposures to arsenic, I thought we may find residues of arsenic in poultry feather meal. So we tested the feather meal and sure enough found residues of arsenic in every sample we tested. We also had been working with a lab that specialized in looking at pharmaceutical compounds in biosolids, and they had developed a method to look at tissue as well. So we thought we'd work with them to look to see what other drugs and personal care product compounds we might find in the feather meal. So we sent it off for testing and found, sure enough, in every sample we tested, between 2 and 10 antibiotics. And what's important there is many of the antibiotics that we use to raise food animals are not a specialized class of veterinary antibiotics. They're the same antibiotics that we'd use to treat infections in humans. And the worry here is that in wasting these antibiotics on animals, we reduce their effectiveness to treat infections in humans. So we're essentially heading in a direction towards a period of time where we may have fewer tools to deal with human infections when they occur.
And just picking up on what you said there, Keith, I was also reading in preparation for the show that most of the antibiotics in this country are used on animals and not on humans.
Yes. The FDA released data last year that allowed us to estimate that 80% of the antimicrobials or antibiotics that are sold in the U.S. are sold for food animals. And the majority of those antibiotics, given current practice, are fed to animals that are healthy. and completely in the absence of a diagnosis of disease. So that is particularly troubling.
And why so much antibiotics used in agriculture? No, go ahead.
I was going to say antibiotics are used in food animal production for a variety of reasons, but the going belief is that the dominant reason is to make them grow faster and to prevent disease. And the reason you'd need to prevent disease is because animals are typically raised in settings that are unhygienic and overly crowded. They're the perfect breeding ground for bacteria.
Let me get you back in on the conversation, Michael Pollan. You told us, you know, not to panic, but we should be certainly aware and probably concerned, and also thinking in sort of activist tones. What do you make of some of the research that Keith Nachman was just talking about?
Well, I followed it when it came out, and I thought it was fascinating. The industry has been able to say he was testing feather meal, not chicken flesh. And so we shouldn't worry. But it seems to me that this is an important piece of research. And we're learning every day about how our food is produced. And every time we do, we're shocked. We'll talk later about pink slime, but that was another example. I mean, the fact that there is so many pharmaceuticals and arsenic and Benadryl and in being fed to chickens that we're eating, these are all kind of teachable moments. And what we learn about is industrial agriculture and the various shortcuts that have been taken to make something like chicken a few pennies cheaper, but at what cost? And so I think it's an important piece of research, and this whole issue of antibiotics and livestock should concern us all. It's not a hypothetical future threat. We're already seeing antibiotic-resistant microbes in our food. Community-acquired staph infections, for example, very big problem, especially in the Midwest, have been linked to pork, to where we raise pork in confinement and feed them antibiotics. And many people who work on those confinement farms are carrying this bug, and many people in the community are carrying it, and it comes from this overuse. It appears to come from this overuse of antibiotics. So there's a food safety threat tied to overuse of antibiotics, and then there is the public health threat, that when you need an antibiotic because of your infection, it may not work anymore because we squandered it on these animals.
And Keith, you also found ingredients for pain relievers, for antidepressants, antihistamines. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, the chemical panel we used to test the feather meal not only included antibiotics, but it also included a number of over-the-counter drugs and non-antibiotic drugs. And we found in a good fraction of the samples residues of acetaminophen, which is the active ingredient in Tylenol. And in a smaller number of samples, we found diphenhydramine, which is the active ingredient in Benadryl. We had two samples of feathers from China, and in those samples, we found residues of fluoxetine, which is the active ingredient in Prozac. We were very surprised to find these things. And really, what it highlighted to us is that the average consumer or even researcher has no way to know what's used in the production of food animals. If you were to pick up the phone and call a poultry producer and ask about a specific drug or ask for the drug regimen that's used to raise their animals, they won't tell you. It's proprietary information. They don't even share it with each other. So that's a huge gap. And as consumers are typically more interested than ever in the practices and the compounds that may be used to produce their food, I think that's a serious problem.
Mm. But are some of these drugs or over-the-counter drugs used to combat stress, for instance? If you've got animals in very tight quarters, are some of these drugs there to mitigate some of the stress and anxiety?
It's a reasonable explanation, but we really struggled to find literature in the animal science world that could support why some of these drugs were used. Now, for certain compounds, we did find, for example, that some of the painkillers are used to relieve stress and reduce the amount of aggression between animals in tight proximity. But for some of them, we had to rely on anecdotes from people who'd been involved in poultry farming for generations, who are now sort of moving away from that, for evidence that those compounds have been used in poultry production.
And is there evidence of impact on the environment, whether it's the land, you know, around these farms or even in the air?
Well, there are various bits of evidence about certain compounds. So I mentioned before that I've spent a lot of time studying the use of arsenical drugs in poultry production. So until last year, 88% of broiler chickens were fed a drug called Roxursone, that is an arsenic-based drug, that resulted just in the state of Maryland in the addition of nearly 15 tons of inorganic toxic arsenic into Maryland's environment on an annual basis. Mm-hmm. So there are certainly instances where some of these compounds pose serious environmental risks.
And do we know what a safe level is, or are we not that far along in the research, Keith?
A safe level in meat or safe level in feathers?
Well,
or
all of the above.
Okay, well, it's challenging. First, we don't have a lot of solid data about the amount of these compounds that stay behind in the meat. And again, since our study only looked at feathers, we can't really say anything about the presence of these compounds in meat. That said, that's something that we're interested in looking into and will likely be doing so. But right now, our evaluation of residues in meats is left up to an agency, a program within the USDA called the Food Safety and Information Service's National Residue Program. And there are documented problems with that program in terms of characterizing what human exposures to some of these residues may be. So in terms of developing safe levels, we're on the way there, but we're not doing the monitoring and surveillance that we need to do to make sure that our exposures are below those levels. But again, you know, we can't say that they're above those levels either. So, you know, there's not enough information right now.
Well, Michael,
Keith, could I just ask Keith a quick question?
Yeah, please do. Go ahead.
Why would you feed arsenic to chickens? What would be the point?
So the arsenical drugs like Roxursone have been approved because they promote growth. They have an effect on the pigmentation of the meat, and they're used to combat certain intestinal parasites.
And pigmentation of the meat, meaning making it look sort of pink and rosy, that kind of
yes,
thing?
Yes, yes.
Michael Pollan, about a minute before our first break here, but based on what Keith Nachman was just telling us, then what kind of research should we be asking for?
Well, I think we should be monitoring what's in what's being fed to chickens, and that information should be publicly available. This is our food. It seems to me we should know what pesticides are being used, what pharmaceuticals. This should just be a matter of course. And, you know, if growers had to list this information publicly, they would be discouraged from using some of these products because it would simply, you know, disturb people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think transparency is a very important thing to fight for here.
And whether it's labeling the actual, you know, chicken itself or on the company website?
You know, whichever. I mean, I'm not sure, but I think we're entitled to a lot more information about how our food is produced. And I look forward to a day where there'll be a second barcode on every package of food that you can scan in the store and figure out just what the animals were fed and the conditions under which they lived and died. I think that would be a very good way to clean up the system and reassure consumers about what they're getting.
Well, we're talking about eating and food, talking with Michael Pollan. He's the author of a number of very popular books. He's also the Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California. Also with us is Keith Nachman. He's Director for Farming for the Future at Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. He's been doing some fascinating research on chicken feed additives. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Greensgrow Farm supports WHYY. The Greensgrow Camden Mobile Markets are open Thursdays and Fridays in 8 Camden neighborhood locations. Full details at greensgrow.org/Camden.
Bristol Riverside Theater supports WHYY and presents Rent, May 8th through June 3rd. Adapted from Puccini's La Boheme and featuring songs including La Vie Boheme, Seasons of Love, One Song Glory, and Light My Candle. Rent, one of the longest-running shows in Broadway history. Tickets and more information at brtstage.org or 215-785-0100.
Starving for attention, hating convention, hating pretension.
Hey, it's not rocket science, but what if it is? Students from Wooddale High School in Memphis, Tennessee are taking their skills and dreams to a national competition, the American Rocketry Challenge. We'll talk with a couple of students from Wooddale about their amazing journey. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is affiliated with the Cleveland Clinic's Heart Surgical Program. Their surgeons are performing breakthrough procedures, including minimally invasive heart valve surgeries. Details at chestercountyhospital.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about what we eat, specifically cows and chickens and pigs. It turns out that chickens in the U.S. are fed antibiotics, pain relievers, other drugs. Industrial farming has indeed made our food cheap, but it has raised some interesting and important concerns about human consumption and the effects of all these medications on human consumption. We're also talking about the controversy over lean, finely textured beef, also known as pink slime. And again, our guests today on Radio Times are food writer Michael Pollan and Keeve Nachman, who does research. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michael Pollan, if I can go back to you, how, though, do you feed a country of 300-plus million, and, of course, then there's the rest of the world, without factory farms?
Well, whether you have factory farms or not, you can feed them without administering pharmaceuticals and antibiotics. I mean, the Europeans have removed antibiotics from their chicken feed and other animal feeds without having to have a complete revolution in their agricultural system. They just kind of lowered the stress and lowered the crowding and cleaned up the chicken houses. So I think posing it as a contrast between, artisanal,
right,
pasture chicken production and factory farming as necessary to feed the world is how the industry would like us to think about the choice, that it's all or nothing. And it really isn't. There's an enormous room to clean up factory farming, even if you don't want to eliminate it. And factory farming can be done in a gentler way than it is being done right now. And the industry would have us think that, well, people are going to starve if we're forced to clean up, and that's simply not the case.
But just picking up on that, Americans also eat a lot of meat, more meat than we used to, and a lot of poultry as well. Does that also, I guess, drive this problem of industrial farming?
Without question. We've turned meat into from a luxury good into something that people consume 9 ounces of per person per day. That's an awful lot of meat. That's more than people have eaten historically. Chicken used to be the expensive protein. It was something you had on Sundays. Pork was the everyday protein, and beef was even cheaper than chicken. And it was only when we learned how to industrialize chicken, a lot of work that Tyson did actually in the 80s and 90s, that and breeding work that was done to make this as cheap as it is. But it's important to look at how we accomplish that. And the way we accomplish that, introduced some public health risks and a great deal of misery to the animals themselves.
Indeed. Let me get you back into the conversation, Keeve Nachman, and then we'll get to some callers as well. But part of what you do is to look at our food production in this country. What do you think the U.S. should do? Obviously, there's some concerns from the Food and Drug Administration and other parts of our farming industry to try to address some of these problems. But what role do you think consumers can play?
Well, that's a really tough question. I mean, I wanted to further highlight Michael's point that, there is no switch that we can flip to a more sustainable system. I think there really are changes that at this point stand out to us as obvious next steps. And I think moving towards a production system that doesn't rely on antibiotics is an important first step in that direction. In terms of what consumers can do, I think they can vote with their dollars, and I think they can get active in learning more about food systems and talking with their politicians to advocate for changes that make sense.
Well, picking up on the antibiotics part, are you saying that use it for sick animals but don't use it as a preventative?
I think that makes good sense. I think when you have a veterinarian diagnosed disease, I think that justifies, for welfare reasons, potentially the use of antimicrobials if they're appropriate in a certain circumstance that you're talking about. But I think generally as a growth promoter or to prevent disease, I think a pharmaceutical intervention is not the way to go. I think cleaning up the environment under which animals are produced, providing a little bit more space, and really making their lives more pleasant is a way to minimize the occurrence of disease in flocks and therefore promote public health. And actually, your question has sort of raised another issue that I'd like to highlight, in that much of our interest around the abuse of antibiotics in food animal production seems to be focused on risks to the consumers. And I just wanted to advocate for the folks who are at greatest risk as a result of the use of these drugs in this setting, and those are people who live in agricultural communities, people who work in animal production facilities, and people who live on the fence line of those communities or on the fence lines of agricultural land where animal waste is spread. Those are the people who are most likely to come into contact with animal waste or bacteria that originate from animal waste that may be resistant to those drugs, and they're often forgotten. These production facilities are disproportionately located in communities of color that are typically low income. So those are the people who are paying the greatest price for the decisions we've made with regard to how we produce animals. And while consumers certainly are suffering from the overall public burden of the wearing away of the effectiveness of our antibiotics, there are people who are much, much more exposed and deserve our attention.
Michael, you want to add to that, talking about farm workers?
Yeah, I think it's often overlooked. There are people who work directly with this. As I said earlier, the people, you know, there are a lot of people who work in hog confinement and hog slaughtering facilities who are dealing with this community-acquired staph infections. And then there's the whole issue of, you know, who lives downstream of these animal feedlots. I mean, all this stuff is in the water. You know, we haven't talked about hormones, too, but those are being administered in the case of beef cattle to make them grow a little faster. And we're finding downstream, you know, fish that have been chemically neutered, displaying, you know, unusual sexual characteristics. And this is a, you know, this is an environmental threat, too, that, you know, these animals, even though that we grow them in these feedlots or in these confinement sheds, they're not separated from the environment. In the end, all these products go back out into the environment. And these are, we have to realize that these are forms of very complex chemical pollution.
Keith, I remember talking to someone, I think it was from the Humane Society, about the space that a chicken lives in. And I believe it's you know, the size of a piece of paper that I'm, you know, frankly looking at here. Does that about describe the kind of space that a chicken lives in their entire life?
Especially when you're talking about layer hens, so chickens that produce eggs. And actually, the Humane Society has recently united with the United Egg Producers to advocate for a bill that would expand the amount of space that's afforded for layer chickens. And that's been an extremely controversial issue on both sides of the equation. I think folks in the animal welfare community have felt that it's too incremental of a change, and really this is not a meaningful change for layer hens, whereas on the other side of the coin, I think the United Egg Producers Association has been under fire from some of the other trade associations within the meat production industry for compromising, essentially, and giving ground on the animal welfare debate. So that's been extremely interesting.
And how?
But let's look at the positive side of this, too. I mean, here we are negotiating with United Egg Producers over production methods. And I think that, you know, we're in the at the very beginning of a national debate over how we're going to raise our foods, but especially our meat. And I think that that's very healthy. This is a huge step from where we were, which is the fact that all this went on invisible, unchallenged, not in the public square, not an appropriate issue for the public square. Well, thanks to, you know, activists, thanks to people like Kiev, thanks to, you know, animal rights protesters, and a handful, a very small handful of legislators, these are now legitimate political issues.
Michael, you had mentioned quote-unquote pink slime, which is another word for lean, finely textured beef. This is a controversy that, you know, bubbled up in the last month. What should we know about pink slime?
Well, I think the important thing to know about pink slime is that we've been eating it for a long time without knowing it. It's one of those things that are in our food that we weren't consulted about. Whether there is a health threat attached to it is open to debate. Basically, it is parts of the animal, connective tissue, that used to be discarded or turned into pet food until a company discovered a way to heat it, then to loosen up the fat and from the protein, and then put it through a centrifuge to separate out the protein from the fat. And then because they had heated it and therefore made it vulnerable to bacterial contamination, they then treated it with ammonia. And in fact, they treated it with so much ammonia that when you mix this stuff into a hamburger, they claimed it would help sanitize the whole burger. You know, the problem, I think, the biggest problem with pink slime, as the name suggests, is the yuck factor. And the industry has responded, there's no scientific case against doing this. Well, food's not just about science. I mean, whether they're right or wrong, I don't know if they're right or wrong, but the fact is, do you want to eat something produced that way? And a lot of people apparently said no. The significance politically of this little episode, and it did bubble up on in social media a few weeks ago, and in the course of a week or two, took down some very large companies. This was a tremendous wake-up call to the industry. They realized that they're vulnerable to this kind of spasm of public interest around how they make food, and that the lesson they take away is, you know, to be fearful of social media. But I think another lesson is that if you're making food in a way that can't stand up to public scrutiny, you're vulnerable. And I think that that is a very important lesson. And I think that that's what we see here. People care about how their food is made, and if you don't have a good story to tell, you better watch out.
Or a good label like Pink Slime, because, Keith, if we were just talking about lean, finely textured beef, I don't think there would be this controversy. But when you call it Pink Slime, then, as Michael Pollan said, then you have the yuck factor.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, by the way, that name was not given to it by activists or journalists. It was given to the product by a USDA microbiologist.
Fair enough. Go ahead, Keith.
I was just going to say that, you know, the pink slime controversy, from my perspective, I agree very much with what Michael has said. It's an indicator of the public's power in the market. You present something that's unpalatable that people don't want to eat, and they actually do have the buying power to induce change where the federal government or regulatory agencies may not be able to do it on their own. And I think that's a really important message, thinking back, again, to some of the issues related to antibiotics and arsenic. If the public is not in favor of using these compounds in this setting, they actually can influence policy and can influence change.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about food safety, how and what we eat, and talking with Michael Pollan and also with Keith Nachman. And we have Lauren from Westchester joining us on Radio Times. And Lauren, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Hi. First, Michael Pollan, you are my hero. My question to you is this. The dairy industry seems to have done a really good job of taking organic dairy products and making them at a reasonable cost and widespread, just as you featured in the movie Food Incorporated, available at Walmart and et cetera. Do you see a future where the meat industry can do the same, where we could get the organic meats at a low cost, widespread, and accepted through the general public? And also, would that create more jobs from local farming industry?
Lauren, thanks for the call. I'll hear first from Michael Pollan, that Keith, I'd like to hear from you as well. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is happening. I mean, I think milk, in a way, was the entry-level product for organic, and it is important. We haven't mentioned that, by the way, if you do buy organic meat, it has not, those animals have not been treated with antibiotics. They're not allowed to use antibiotics at all in organic production. So if you're concerned about avoiding that, for whatever reason, that is a good alternative.
And when it says organic, it means organic, Michael?
Yeah. I think that we can trust the label. There have been very few cases of fraud that I'm aware of. I think that there are some limitations, that the label does not mandate everything you would like to see, perhaps, in meat production. There are organic factory farms, and it's important to know this, but they are better than the conventional ones by several different measures. The animals do have access to the outside, access to pasture now in the case of organic milk. And I think that we will see this market grow. Whether how far down the price will come is hard to say. There's an enormous disconnect between the demand for organic animal protein and the supply. And there is prices of organic grain, which you need to feed your organic animals, have gone through the roof, and it's become very expensive to feed animals organically. But there's no question that chains like Walmart and a great many others want to stock organic meat, and that we will be seeing more of it in the future.
Keith, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I would add there is a separate label aside from the USDA organic label that is antibiotic-free or antimicrobial-free, and that label actually does carry meaning. It can be trusted. And there's a growing body of scientific literature now that's actually showing that antibiotics are not cost-effective in meat production. Mm-hmm. Across every class of animal, this has been examined in many cases by ag researchers and by USDA researchers. The most recent one I'm aware of was a study that was conducted by Texas A&M that looked at 500,000 meat chickens and found that antibiotics had no effect across five different indices of production. So really, the use of antimicrobials is completely unnecessary from a cost-benefit perspective.
Is that because the antibiotics cost so much, or it just doesn't have the kind of desired effect that farmers are looking for?
I think it's a combination of the two.
I was also reading, and I'll put this back to you, Michael Pollan, that Burger King has said that they want to use eggs that are cage-free eggs. Also, this is not, I think, by the year 2017, so it's not imminent. But nonetheless, do you see some of these fast food chains getting pressure to do something?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, this is a case where activism has paid off. And all those crazy blood-throwing, animal rights have actually moved the debate in a positive direction. And Burger King also vowed to stop taking pork from confinement operations that keep their sows confined to tiny little pens, which is a particularly brutal practice of animal agriculture. I think these practices will be, obsolete fairly soon. And it is the result not so much of government intervention. The government has really been following more than leading on all these issues. But because of outraged consumers and people organizing. I mean, we do have a food movement in this country. It's inchoate and doesn't, always speak with one voice, but there is a tremendous amount of political energy and alert and upset consumers that are driving change. And the industry is working very hard to at one point attack that movement and in other ways respond to it in ways that they feel give them maximum advantage. I mean, McDonald's has taken positive steps too on the way that they slaughter beef, for example, and they're very close to moving on things like sow crates and cages for laying hens also. So we just have to keep the heat up.
Well, and Keith, we have to say goodbye to you in just a moment or two, but I'm curious about the research that you're working on now. What's your next project?
I think the next logical step for us, based on what we found in feathers, would be to look in meat and try and say something about what people might come into contact with when they eat meat. And if I could, I wanted to add one point related to what Michael just said, and that's that animal welfare has actually been demonstrated in the scientific literature to be connected to public health. Animals under stress are more likely to shed bacteria and viruses and spread communicable disease, and that certainly has implications for public health. So it's important to keep that in mind as well.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Keith Nachman, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, and thanks for your research as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Director for Farming for the Future at Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, Michael Pollan, staying with us for the rest of the hour. His Food Rules and Eaters Manual has been re-released, and it's illustrated now. We'll talk more about food and what we eat and how we eat, and we'll take some more calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by the new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro. Opening May 22nd, the new hospital is being built with all single-patient rooms and has been designed with innovations that may help improve healing and lower infections. Features include a new rapid-response emergency room and CHOP docs to care for children. The new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro, redefining care. Opening May 22nd. More at princetonhcs.org.
On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, the imam famous for trying to build an interfaith Islamic center near Ground Zero. His new book is called Moving the Mountain, Beyond Ground Zero to a New Vision of Islam in America. Also, Gretchen Reynolds talks about the latest scientific research into exercise and fitness. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Facebook is expected to be valued at tens of billions of dollars at its IPO, but one analyst says the company might not even be around in 5 years. Also, Tony Award winner Bernadette Peters. The sound you just heard was theater lovers fainting. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Michael Pollan famously wrote, "Eat food, not too much, mostly plants." He's going to stay with us for the rest of the hour. His book, Food Rules, an Eater's Manual, has been re-released. It's now illustrated. He also wrote In Defense of Food and the Omnivore's Dilemma, and he is the Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. And I do want to pick up on some of these rules that you have expanded on in this new book. But nonetheless, the sort of basic rules of eating from your perspective is what? Eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
Yeah, it's really simple, and it's a lot simpler than you would think walking through the grocery store as you're assaulted by all these you know, improbable and in some cases completely false health claims. The challenge is knowing what food is, because there's a lot of pretenders to that beautiful word, and so a lot of the book is offering a set of rules to help you distinguish real food from what I call edible food-like substances.
Well, I want to pick up on that, but even just picking up on what we were talking about with Keith Nachman and all these new studies looking at antibiotics and some of these additives that are used in our food production or our meat production, you also begin your book saying that we are just bombarded with all sorts of reports and studies, what's safe, what isn't safe, and it's hard sometimes to know what we should be eating when everyone tells us to do this or do that or don't do this or don't do that.
I think that's right. I think we've been ill-served, both by the government and even the academic nutrition community. You know, we spent 20 or 30 years being obsessed with dietary fat,
right,
and that this was the problem with heart disease and this was the problem with overweight. Well, you know, nobody has actually stepped out before the cameras to tell us, oops, we were wrong about that. But in fact, if you read the literature, there is a growing acknowledgement that, in fact, there was never a lot of research linking, say, saturated fat, animal fats, to heart disease. That research was always very sketchy. I think there are two studies that have drawn that link and hundreds that have failed to draw that link. And that, in fact, we're coming around to suspect that a lot of these chronic diseases are linked to inflammation, and that sugar is a bigger concern than fat is. So it's no wonder people are confused. They've had a lot of confusing information. And, you know, we had food pyramids that were telling us exactly the wrong thing for a very long time.
You teach journalism. Do you blame the press in part? I mean, you get these you know, headlines to tell you something is good for you or something is bad for you, but do you think the sort of hysterical headlines about food has done a disservice?
Yeah. Oh, I think journalism is complicit in this problem. I think that there's been a tendency to overhype any new study that comes along. The more contrarian, the better. But I also think that the food manufacturers who use health claims to sell food to us are also guilty of overhyping, you know, very slender information. You know, pomegranate juice, you know, is not going to, like, prevent heart disease by itself. These superfoods are completely, yeah, they have antioxidants, but guess what? Every plant has antioxidants. These things are a dime a dozen. So there is, you know, you can go out now and buy, you can take your food or your fruit or your vegetable, whatever it is, and have someone test it. And lo and behold, they will find some very healthy nutrients in it. That's because people have been eating them for tens of thousands of years. And then to advertise those nutrients as the key to long life and happiness is pure hype. So, you know, the marketing, I think, is a big part of the problem. And then government food advice, which has been heavily compromised by industry. Our government is not allowed to speak freely or honestly about food. They must negotiate many of these recommendations with the industry, which is an astonishing fact, but lobbying works even when you're talking about food pyramids.
Wow. But you are a critic of the, you know, the Western diet, and this is the diet that, that's high in fats, it's high in sugars, high in it's highly processed.
Yeah, well, I do think we eat too much meat. You know, the most controversial recommendation in the book, Mostly Plants,
yes,
manages to annoy both vegetarians for not going all the way. Why doesn't he just go all the way? Mm-hmm. And carnivores for not acknowledging how wonderful meat is. You know, I like meat, and I think meat is a perfectly nutritious food that, that we humans have been eating for a long time. But we're eating tremendous amounts of it, and we have research that suggests that eating red meat in particular in quantities is not good for you. And we do also know that vegetarians are very healthy. They live longer. They have less heart disease. But guess what? Flexitarians, people who eat a little bit of meat, maybe meat a couple nights a week, are just as healthy as the vegetarians. So we tend to fall into this all-or-nothing approach to food, you know, that if you have one bit of meat as a vegetarian, you're falling off the wagon. But I'm counseling kind of a kind of moderate position on this. And I continue to eat meat, but I'm really picky about the meat I eat. And, you know, people talk about how raising animals in a sustainable way on small farms, on pasture, is going to make the meat more expensive. And that's true. But maybe we need to go back to a time where meat was a very special occasion food. So I eat meat that probably costs twice as much as the meat I used to eat, but I eat half as much of it, and I get a lot more pleasure.
It sounds like human beings are basically omnivores from your perspective.
It appears that we are. I mean, you know, we have the teeth that allow us to eat many different kinds of things, including meat and grinding grain and all this kind of stuff. And we have the digestive equipment to eat a lot of different things. That doesn't oblige us to eat anything. It
right.
gives us options.
Nothing wrong with options. Let me see what Allison from West Philadelphia has to say. And Allison, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi Michael
there.
Pollan, you're also my hero.
You have a lot of fans
I
there.
I wanted to ask about the cost of food, actually, because I feel like, you know, you always say that we pay a whole lot less of our income in to food than we did in, like, the 50s. And I find, like, that's the biggest obstacle towards people eating well is the sense that they need to buy the cheapest food.
Mm. I think you're absolutely right.
I'm curious what you think might work to make a cultural shift there.
Thanks,
well,
Allison.
You know,
yes.
I think that's a great question. It's really a job for people who tell stories and are on the kind of humanities side of the spectrum. It's not a scientific question. It really is. I mean, I see part of my work is as encouraging people to spend more money on food if they can, because it's so wonderful when it's produced well. And this is a job for chefs, too, who, you know, kind of enchant us with what they can do with food and persuade us, you know, every day that food is worth mm-hmm. spending more money on. I think part of it is celebrating it and showing people that it's not an issue of quality, but quantity. I mean, when you eat, are you just looking for a sheer onslaught of calories, or are you looking for a certain kind of experience? And that kind of experience, you know, you can be more satisfied eating a little less of good food than just giant, you know, supersized platters of the stuff, which is how the marketing usually works. So there's a trade-off between quality and quantity, and it's our job as people who talk to the culture to celebrate quality and move the focus there.
And we have so many poor people in this country, many of them living on food stamps or near food stamp amounts of money. And Michael, you know, I think part of the question is, you know, how do you get high-quality, good-tasting food that is affordable as well, if you eat less meat?
You eat less meat and you learn how to cook. You know, one of the ways to eat well on a budget is to cook food yourself. Processed food looks cheap, but when you actually do the math, and Mark Bittman's done some great columns on this,
yeah.
You know, you can cook a fast food meal that will be a lot cheaper and taste a lot better than McDonald's or Burger King. The problem is that we've lost those skills and devalued those skills as a culture, and we've been convinced that it's really hard to cook well. Many of us have parents who don't cook anymore, and we no longer teach cooking in the schools. So I think the best way to help people without a lot of money to eat healthy food is to teach them how to cook, to figure out if you do buy that one, say, organic or pastured chicken, that you're going to get three meals out of it for your family if you know what to do with it. And those skills, you know, that's the history of cooking, by the way, is peasants figuring out how to make wonderful things out of inauspicious ingredients. And now, a lot of us don't have time to cook, or at least we tell us that, ourselves that. But I think it's important, and that may be true for some people, but I think we all need to do a little inventory about how do we spend our time. We've all found 2 hours a day to spend online outside of work in the last 10 years. You know, is it really true you don't have time, or is it something else?
Allison, thanks for the call. Let's see what Marissa from Springhouse has to say. And Marissa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Michael. I also just adore your work. I think it's absolutely terrific. I have a question. I was wondering, how close do you think we are to having our food labeled genetically modified, as they're beginning to do in other countries? And are we getting any closer in terms of raising awareness around the issues surrounding GMOs?
Thanks, Marissa.
Yeah, you know, it's a very good question. I kind of despaired of that ever happening a few years ago because, you know, both parties have been really hostile toward labeling genetically modified food, and both parties have been very friendly to the companies that produce it. But over the last few months, a very successful campaign has gotten started called, I think it's called Just Label It. That was pioneered by, among other people, Gary Hirschberg, the former CEO of Stonyfield. He started the yogurt company. And they have managed to raise, put together about 1 million signatures on a petition. They're putting enormous pressure on the FDA, which has the could order the labels to be included. And they're putting a lot of pressure on Obama, who... people forget, but at an appearance in Iowa during the campaign, he said, we do have the right to know if we're eating genetically modified food. So he needs to be reminded of that promise as often as possible. So I think we're closer to getting labeling than we have been since these products were introduced. And I also think the general issue of our right to know when it comes to what's in our food, it's very hard for the industry to argue against this. They claim it confuses consumers. That was an argument made when dairies wanted to put on their milk cartons that they weren't selling milk from cows treated with bovine growth hormone. But it seems to me this is, you know, whatever you think of GM food, if it's such a boon to mankind, let's tell people about it.
Fair enough. Marissa, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Michael, how much do you think high fructose corn syrup has made us fatter and less healthy?
Okay, well, let me be careful here.
Okay.
High fructose corn syrup, which is a relatively newcomer to the American diet, it really doesn't get introduced till the early 80s when the big soda company switched over to it, has contributed to obesity and diabetes. But not necessarily in a unique way. Many people think that high fructose corn syrup is somehow worse than sugar. It's very much like sugar and may not be any worse than sugar. There are still a few researchers who think it may be metabolized in a different way. Fructose is worse than sugar. And fructose, you know, is metabolized differently and is stored as fat much more quickly than glucose. But it's important to understand that even high fructose corn syrup is not so high in fructose. It's about 50-50, I think 55-45. So it's not that different than sugar. In general, we need to reduce the amount of fructose in our diet, but doing that means cutting down on sugar. You know, we're eating something like 140 pounds of sugar per person in a year. And if you want to point to one thing that could cause the kinds of chronic diseases we're dealing with, it's sugar consumption at those levels. The other problem with high fructose corn syrup is it appears in items that were never sweetened before. So when it came along, the industry started sweetening things like bread, which didn't, you know, classically didn't have sugar in it. Relishes, pickles, all sorts of processed foods get high fructose corn syrup because it's cheap and because it makes food more attractive.
And it is pretty shocking if you take the time to read labels to not only see what's, you know, in a can of something or other, but also how high up on that list is high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah, look at things like ketchup. You know, you're getting sugar everywhere. So it is why, I do recommend that people look at labels, and if they see high fructose corn syrup, don't buy it. Not because it's worse than sugar, but because it's a marker of a highly processed food. I mean, who do you know who cooks with high fructose corn syrup at home?
Haven't tried that yet. You say eat like the French, the Japanese, the Italians, or the Greeks.
Yeah, you know, cuisines, you know, these kind of wonderful old systems of eating have wisdom in them. You know, the Italians have always combined tomatoes with olive oil, for example. It turns out that there's a very good scientific reason to do that. The lycopene in the tomato is made accessible to your body when it's dissolved in oil. So there is wisdom in cuisines that's worth paying attention to. The way foods are combined, the orders in which they're eaten. You know, the French have cheese at the end of a meal. Well, it turns out that that helps prevent tooth decay because you're lowering the pH. I'm sorry, you're raising the pH in your mouth before you go to bed. So food traditions are reservoirs of knowledge that's often way ahead of the scientists.
Well, Michael Pollan, you made me hungry, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you, Marty. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. The new book, Food Rules and Eater's Manual, now illustrated by Mara Kalman. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program, including email, Twitter, Facebook, podcasts, archives. It's all there. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show was produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.